Now it is my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker. Please give a warm Valley Group welcome to Jane.
Good evening, everyone. My name is James. I'm an alcoholic. And I want to welcome the newcomers to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to start my experience, strength, and hope, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. What it was like when I was 9 years old, I can remember vividly one Sunday telling my parents I was sick. I didn't want to go to church. And they allowed me to stay home. I think I had an ulterior motive at 9 years old. Because I had a neighbor live behind us, Mr. Robert. He was a good gentleman. He used to sit in his yard on the weekend, and he used to drink Old Milwaukee 16-ounce can six-pack. And as soon as my parents and my sibling left to go to church, I politely got out of bed and went over to Mr. Robert. And I don't know if he offered me a beer or I asked him for one. But I can remember him saying this to me. Don't you tell your dad I gave you this beer. Don't you tell Mr. Bill. That was my dad's name. They called him Mr. Bill. I said, okay, I won't tell him. So I drink the beer and we sit there and chit-chat. Mind you, I have already lied to my parents that I was sick, so I had to get home and pretend like I was sick without them smelling the beer on my breath. So they came from church, and that little incident kind of went over pretty well. I got away with it. So again, I guess that started my getting away with stuff. My process of getting away, you know, trying this and trying that to see how far I can go and get away with it. And I can also remember growing up, I used to hang around with older guys. Mind you, I'm a southern boy. I'm not talking about from southern L.A. No, I'm talking about from the deep south, Mississippi, born and bred, okay? And you get any further south, you'll be in the Gulf of Mexico, basically. And I used to hang around with older gentlemen. And I consider those older gentlemen professional drinkers, which they were. So I wanted to learn how to drink like a normal person. And where do I get that experience from? Someone who has experience with drinking. So here I am, you know, over the years, you know, 15, 16, hanging around with guys, 30, 40 years old, you know. They go to work, professional, you know, and they get off work, and after school, that's where I go and hang out with to get some knowledge on how to drink like a normal person. And I can remember drinking, and I went home one night, and I got in bed, and the bed started spinning. Well, you can best believe the next thing that was on my mind was, hey guys, what do you do when the bed starts spinning? That was my question to them when I went back, you know, what do you do? One gentleman told me, well, you got to put one leg on the floor. You guys probably didn't heard that. Well, you know, the whole house started spinning then, you know. So it was more like the Wizard of Oz type thing, you know. Get me out of this thing, you know. And then the other one was, what do you do about throwing up? They said, well, you got to eat a good meal before you start drinking. Have something on your stomach to absorb the alcohol. You know, well, that didn't work either, you know. Because what I put on there evidently came back up. That continued for a number of years, and I don't think I was an alcoholic. I just liked to drink. I was experimenting. Okay, I was experimenting. And I can also remember when my alcoholism really took hold. 21, I went into the military. From 81 to 89. I went into the military. I went to Fort Dix, New Jersey, basic training. A southern boy from Mississippi up there in New Jersey, you know, December 31st, winter, snow, so first thing I wanted was some antifreeze, you know, something to heat up the blood in my system, not knowing that it makes you get colder. And I can remember we used to drink NyQuil. You know, NyQuil had a percentage of alcohol on it, you know, and we used to drink that. And then after I left there, I ended up going to Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio, Texas, back to the sunshine. And I can remember I was going through advanced training. My MOS was 91 Bravo. If you guys ever seen the MASH television series, the Comeback Medic, when they holler medic, that was my MOS. That's what I had to do. So I can remember at Fort Sam Houston, when I get there, my company commander said, "Okay, guys, we're going to give you some free time to go take care of your personal business. This doesn't mean go get drunk or go down to the PX or whatever and get something to drink." Well, as soon as formation dismissed, guess where I went? First place I went. And I sat there at a table and I got a big pitcher of beer with a mug, and I sat down there and I was just drinking up a storm. And my company commander, I guess he had experience with that somebody was going to disobey an order, you know. You know, I was an undisciplined soldier, but anyway. So he came through, and he seen my insignia on my shoulder, and he asked for my military ID. "I'm a recruit. I don't know nothing." Reach in my wallet, give it to him, and he walk off with it. You know, that's something like giving your license to the police department. When the police pull you over for a DUI, you give them your license, they just keep it. That's how I felt. Well, it was some veterans over there at this table. They saw what happened. They said, "Come here, young soldier." They called me over there and they said, "Why did you give him your..." I said, "He asked for it." They said, "Well, that's one order you can refuse. You know, you will follow him anywhere he want to go, but you will not relinquish your military ID because you're on a military installation with no form of identification." But his idea was he knew where I was by my military ID. So the next thing happened was they called. We was out on bed like doing the drill exercise, and they called me in to see my company commander. You know, I'm a private E2. So they can't take too much money from me. They can't demote me. They didn't kick me out of the army. But what he did do, he restricted me to barracks for 2 weeks. You know, you have this camaraderie, like the fellowship. We look out for one another. Well, it's the same thing in the army. I had a buddy who was doing security of the barracks I was in. He was looking out for me. I gave him maybe $20 or $30. "Hey, man, go down to the PX and get me some beer." Lo and behold, that's what he did. He went and got me a six-pack, a 16-ounce can, slit small liquor bore. And I'm restricted to barracks, right? So after I downed the beers, I got empties. You know, the beer can. Now, how in the hell am I going to get rid of these? Alcoholic mind. "Hey, flush him down the toilet. Flush him down the toilet." I'm drunk, you know, so I'm here ripping up cans trying to flush him down the toilet. And guess what happened? Backed up the system. I don't know what happened. Well, I made it through that, you know. But that's when I realized I had a problem with alcohol. And that continued, you know. I did 8 years. You know, I got out in 89, luckily with an honorable discharge. Returned back to my home state, the beautiful Magnolia State of Mississippi. And visit some of my old professional drinkers, the old guys still hanging around, still doing what they're doing. Fell right back into the same thing. And some of you guys might ask, well, James, how in the hell you get to California? Different story, not going to go there. But anyway, here I am. You know, you do a geographical to try to, you know, change your life. You know, alcohol, you know, California, if I say, is, you know, plentiful. But anyway, back in Mississippi, they had a certain thing. You guys might be familiar with bootleggers, you know. After the liquor store closed, they had this certain guy that you had to know a guy to know this guy to get what you want, you know. But anyway, I did a geographical and I came to California. And in my stint here, I ended up straightening up my act for about a year. Ended up getting a job with a reputable hotel chain, Marriott, out of Oakland. Was working with them and working in the maintenance department, engineering, whatever you want to call it. And we used to pick up stewardess airline pilots or crews from Oakland International Airport to come to the Marriott Courtyard to stay until their next flight. And it was a lot of JetBlue crews coming in, the red eye from New York, East Coast. And when they get there, first thing they want, where can I get a drink? Now, I got all the keys to pretty much everything in the hotel. I was working from 7 in the evening to 7 in the morning. So they called me up to the front desk and say, oh, James, you think you can get this crew? I said, well, the bar is closed. And, you know, my supervisor gave me specific instructions not to unlock the bar. But as soon as we leave the front desk, you know, the airline crew are known for tipping. You know, so I had no problem with accepting tips for a favor, you know. James, you think you can get a bottle and bring it up to my room? All right, this between me and you. Don't tell nobody, you know. About 4 or 5 people, you know, in this crew, you know, don't tell nobody. So I used to unlock it and take them their drinks. And then it got to the point that I said, okay, I got the keys to the liquor room, the bar. And mind you, in the hotels, they have rooms that are called out of order. Wallpaper might be coming off the wall. Might not have a television in it. Might not have a bed. Or housekeeping hasn't made it there yet, so they're not going to rent it out. Well, in the wee hours of the night, 2 or 3 in the morning, you know, I get kind of bored. So I politely go there and I unlock the bar and I get me something to drink and I go in one of these out of order rooms and I got my walkie-talkie on the nightstand in case the front desk need me, they can call me. You know, you guys probably seen that movie Flight with Denzel Washington. Hello. So I sit there and I end up, you know, getting toasted. But I don't suppose to, when my shift is over at 7, I don't suppose to be on the property. And one particular morning, my supervisor came in, and I got to try to sneak off the hotel property without him seeing me, but that didn't work. And I ended up getting a write-up for being on company property, you know. I don't think he smelled the alcohol. That never came up. I don't think they did inventory, or the bartender never did inventory, because that never came up also. So 9/11 happened, so I ended up, well, in that time I ended up getting married while I was in Oakland. And that was a weird situation, but anyway, I ended up getting married. I ended up getting married, you know, the marriage lasted 2 years. And 9/11 happened, so planes aren't flying. So I was the last person hired, the first one laid off. So me and my newly bride, we moved to Hanford to live with her sister until we found a place here in Visalia, over off Douglas and Ben Maddox. Some people might be familiar with Holiday Homes. So we lived over there for a while, you know, and we, you know, try to make do. And my ex-wife, she liked to host company. We used to have this beautiful decanter little cart thing, you know, the glass cart with the little ice chest and all that thing with the bottle. And she used to like to keep it in the house for company. She would go to work. I wasn't working. She would come home and the bottle would be empty. What happened to all the liquor? She said, it's for company. I said, well, excuse the expression. Hell, I live here. I mean, if it's for company, I think I ought to be able to drink whatever I want in my own home, you know. But she didn't pretty much like that. Well, like I said, the marriage lasted for 2 years, so she packed up everything and she moved back to Oakland. She left me with four walls, blinds on the windows, and carpet on the floor. And I wasn't working. So I tried to make do. I talked to the landlord. And so the landlord gave me a position to accept rent from the other tenants to take care of my rent. But still, how do I pay care of the bills, you know? So I ended up staying there, ended up losing the apartment, losing the little job, and became homeless. You know, I guess circumstances, situations in my life that I thought I wasn't at fault. You know, it wasn't my fault that she left. I got in a depressed mode. You know, like, damn, James, you can't do nothing right. So I ended up homeless on the streets of Australia, and I used to camp out at Seroptimus Park on Douglas. I mean, you guys familiar with that. And I have lived 8 years through the wonderful weather here in the valley. Rain, shine, sleet, snow, you name it. And my alcoholism commenced to get worse, you know. Pretty much I conceded, this is the way I'm going to live. This is the way I'm going to die here in Visalia on the streets, a drunk. Sleeping wherever I can. And this one particular place used to be a place called Straw Hat Pizza on Ben Maddox in the corner of Douglas. And behind that place were cubby holes. And my moment of clarity came unexpectedly. But in my final throes of alcoholism, I can remember laying there one winter night on a cardboard box, drink in hand, looking up at the stars, starry night, looking up at the stars. And one of the best and most sincere prayer I ever said was, God, help me. I don't want to live like this no more. And when I said that prayer, I wouldn't have been surprised if a bolt of lightning would have struck me in the head. Because I was desperate. I wouldn't have been surprised. But it didn't happen on my time. But I put the plea out there in the universe to whatever higher power you want to believe in, but my higher power is God. I put the petition out there, God help me. So a year later, unbeknownst to me, an event of circumstances came into play. And I still consider it an honor and a privilege to speak here tonight at the Creative Center, Ice House, whatever you want to call it. Because that divine intervention happened to me right here. Bridge, I'm coming from Lee's Market, beer in hand. You know, during those 8 years, I used to have a bike to get around those 8 years of homelessness, to get around to these different spots. And these spots I'm talking about is convenience stores. Because I had got down to the point, I was that guy. When you pull up to the liquor store, you lock your car, you walk around the other way. I was that guy in front of the liquor store. Want to wash your windows for a little change. Want to do whatever, you know, carry your 12-pack out to your car. Hoping you give me one, and you hoping I don't run off with it. See, I'm that guy. So my divine intervention came right here. I'm leaving Lee's Market with a beer in hand and turning off Douglas on the Ben Maddox. Lo and behold, here's Visalia Finest. And it's something I never did. You know, not that I was fearful of the police, but I know it's certain things you shouldn't do in public, and one of them is drink. So I'm riding my bike, got a 40 ounce in a paper bag, here come the cops, and here I am meeting each other, and I wave at him with like a damn fool. And I wave at him. Usually, I will hide it, turn off, try to evade, but I wave at him. Well, you know, what's his next thing? Oh, he you know, I got his attention all right. And I don't know why I did that, but anyway, he turned around, got behind me, got me for public intoxication. I went down to main jail. Bike went in the trunk. I went in the back seat. Yeah. So down the main jail I went, and you know, it's a sleep it off, you know, so they, you know, being released on your own recognizance, but still I had a court date. And I had to go back in front of, at the time it was Judge Couillard. And they suggested that I get into a program. And the program was AA. You know, so looking back on how all this came about, what part did James have to play in this? James got sick and tired of being sick and tired. James got desperate. And James wanted some help. James couldn't live that way no more. And God did for me what I couldn't do for myself, with the help of our Savior Finest again. So they got me on the Prop 36 program, and they sent me to New Heights. At the time, New Heights was down by Glitz Meat Market. And mind you, I'm still homeless. I would go there and attend the meetings. I would attend my one-on-one. And when I would leave there, guess where I would go? Back to familiar territory. My old buddies. People, places, and things. I didn't know about AA. I didn't know about the fellowship. I didn't know that we're here to help each other. So I would go back over there where I knew they would understand. You know, oh, James, you're all right. Let's get a drink. So I can remember one morning I went to a New Heights to do my one-on-one. As soon as I walked in the door, one of the counselors looked at me and pointed and said, "Hey, I got to make a phone call on you." I go, "Oh, crap. He's going to call the cops, he's going to call the probation officer, he's going to call somebody other than who I thought he was calling." He called Pine Recovery.
That's right.
And he said, "Go to Pine. They got a bed waiting on you right now." He didn't say, "I'm going to take you to Pine Recovery." He said, "Go there." Here I am again with a damn choice. So riding my bike from down Murray, get right there by the library. I'm on the left side of the road, mind you, okay, because Pine is on the right side by the library. I'm on the left side. And one of the scariest and best decisions I ever made was to make that right turn and go to Pine. But I'm doing this on my bike, you know. So I made the right turn, I parked my bike, I walked up the steps, and one of the counselors said, "We thought you weren't going to make it, or we thought you wasn't going to come." So I walked up there and I got in the Pine. And I did 90 days. And Pine had a ritual. Some of you guys might be still familiar with that ritual. Once you complete their program, they used to keep a big water cooler out in the courtyard at Pine. And whenever someone get ready to exit the program, they kind of, you know, you're an alumni of Pine now, and they kind of, like the football coach thing, kind of drown you in it. Well, when I got ready to, didn't nobody get around to do that to me, and I felt, you know, not a part of. You know, and I've been feeling that way a long time. And I say a long time, you know, because I was born in the 60s in Mississippi. A lot of shit was going on. Excuse the expression. Okay, so I felt not a part of. And I kind of mentioned that to one of the one of my buddies there, and he kind of got the word out. You know, James wanted to be baptized or whatever the case is. You know, James wanted to be baptized, so they officially got me. Thank you. I was happy. You know, so I exited the program. But I still didn't have a home. I'm still homeless. Well, James, keep coming to meetings, you know, fine, get you a sponsor, find you a home, work your big, you know, I did all that, you know, doing pine, the steps and everything. So, but when I was at pine, I was safe. I felt safe. And I can relate that security to a baby in his mom's womb. And then the baby being burst out like, what the hell is this? So when I left Pine, I'm back into society. And I don't know how to deal with it. I don't know how to deal with you guys. And you guys don't know how to deal with me. So it was getting close to my birthday. And I ended up living in someone's garage who kind of felt pity for me and let me live in their garage. Well, she had a son, and her son was like 19. His name was Robert, too. Coincidence, Mr. Robert, my first Vietnam here with a teenager named Robert. So he wanted to help me celebrate my birthday, belly button birthday, July 10th. And he was like, come on, James, come on, you know. Let's. I said, nah, man, I'm in recovery and, you know, my willpower. I don't want it. So he kind of left me alone. So in the wee hours of the night, when everybody is asleep in the house, hey, Robert, you still got some of that beer? Yeah, James. 2 or 3 o'clock, July 10th. Got drunk. Well, when I left Pine, they said, keep coming back. I didn't know it was going to be that soon. So I ended up going back and admitting to the fellowship, to my fellow pine nuts, that I relapsed. And guess what I was greeted with? Welcome back. Welcome back, Glenn. Glad you came back. So I went and talked to the staff there. This guy named Steve Cummings. I'm like, man, I ain't ready for society, man. I need something else. So they got me in the January house. And that's where I learned how to deal with society. Because the only requirement that they had there were you do your chores and you don't do drugs or alcohol. And you go to meetings. I can do that. But while I was there, I started seeing promises come true for me. You know, I ended up being granted disability. I had 2 knee replacements, you know. I ended up being granted disability, back pay and all that whoop-de-doop good stuff. I met a beautiful woman here, 2 beautiful kids, you know, Hannah and Jonah, Sylvia, you know, in recovery. So I learned how to deal with managing money, for one thing, because me and money had a bad understanding. When I was actively drinking, we had a bad understanding. I couldn't keep it, you know, the liquor store man, you know. But so we ended up getting a place over on Douglas, an apartment, so we're not homeless no more. Like I said, we're not homeless no more. And from that day to this day, we're still not homeless no more. And that's somewhere I refuse to go back to. Seen it, lived it, bucket list, check. Certain things that I had to do, I learned how to manage money. I learned how to use money for what money is used for. Paying your bills. Getting groceries. Getting a car. I still have a bike, but I also have a car now. Matter of fact, everyone in my family, except my daughter, she had a bike. We got to get her one. But anyway, got a bike, and have 2 automobiles now. Living in a 3-bedroom, 2-bath. house, from an apartment to a house. Those are the blessings, those are the promises, those are things that are coming true, that have came true to me. You know, so I'm here sharing my message to give you guys hope that no matter what you're going through, it can get better. It can get better. I've been in this program 12 years. If the Lord's willing, coming up May 5th, 2017, I have 8 years. Woo! So that goes to show you, those first 4 years, or 11 and a half years, 3.5 years, I don't want to say, was trying every imaginable remedy to pull the wool over the judge's eyes, over the probation officer's eyes, to get away, like I did when I was 9 years old, to get away with stuff. You know, I was still doing that those first 3.5 years. Until it clicked. I read the first 164 pages, and I continue to read the literature of Alcoholics Anonymous. My fiance introduced me to my home group, which is Bridge Street Drunks. And there, when I first went there, I used to sit way back. And we use the daily reflections over there to, you know, go off. And I used to sit way back in the back. Because I didn't want you guys to know who I was, and I didn't really give a crap who you guys was. But I heard something there. I heard the message. You know, the message was hope. And the promise that they told me was recovery. Freedom from alcohol. Our message is hope. Our promise is freedom from alcohol. So I ended up getting a sponsor. I ended up helping others. I ended up doing the triangle. Service, unity, recovery. And those are the things that keeps me sober today. You know, to reach out to the next suffering alcoholic. You know, but they said we had to practice these principles in all our affairs. Easier said than done. I'm glad you, some of you guys chuckle because you can agree. You know, and I find, you know, one of the hardest part or places to practice these principles is with loved ones in your own home. But that's where it needs to start. And I'm guilty. I have character defects, trust me. And some of them still have a tendency. God, remove them, you know. You know, I ask God to remove my shortcomings. And sometimes I take them back. I think I can use this one a little bit longer. I can hold on to this one a little bit. You know, it's a lot of times when I really think about this thing called intuitive thought. Intuitive thought. God doing for me what I can do for myself. Because there was a lot of times I knew I was going to do something that I shouldn't be doing. And I hear this little, James, don't go do that.
Yeah.
James, don't go do that. James, don't say that. And you know what I usually turn around and say? Hold on a minute, God, I'll get with you in a second. You know, me telling God, I'll get with you in a second. And guess what? Okay, go right ahead, young man, go right ahead. And I go right ahead and I end up somewhere I don't want to be. Or in a situation which I wouldn't have participated in. So now I really listen to those intuitive thoughts. Because they keep me out of trouble. You know, trouble is easy to get into, but hard to get out of. So I came up with this acronym, and I rarely use it, but I need to start practicing it myself. And it's for the word pause. You know, because I try to stay in emotional balance, in fair weather or foul, the acid test. I try to stay in emotional balance. So sometimes I have to pause. P-A-U-S-E. And the acronym that I use for that is please allow us some enjoyment. And that's what I have in life today. Sober enjoyment. My life, it's pretty good. And I'm going to use this expression here, or this analogy. My life right now, compared to what it used to be like, it's like a bed of roses. One problem. My bed of roses have thorns. And that's what I have to watch out for. Those thorns. Because those thorns can prick me and get me back into myself, or get me back in a situation that I don't want to be in. So I have to learn to sidestep the booby trap. Pluck out the thorns to keep me from returning to where I used to be. I have learned to deal with disappointments. I've learned to accept. Acceptance is the key. My life, my situation in life, because I also realize that it's only temporary. This too shall pass. One of my biggest triggers for drinking, I was at a meeting over at Bridge Street, and I got a call from my baby sister back in Mississippi, wailing, incoherent, couldn't understand what she was saying, but I can feel the anguish in her voice. Her only daughter died of lupus, and I wasn't there to comfort my baby sister. And I was at a meeting at Bridge Street, and I went in there and said, I'm finna go get drunk. I'm hurting. I'm not there. I'm finna go get drunk. You know, because a closed mouth don't get fed. I could have held that bottled up in me, but I didn't. I went in there and I shared it at a meeting. And after the meeting was over, two members of the fellowship came to me and pulled me aside. One of them told me, said, James, if you use your niece, death, as a reason to go get drunk, you're a piece of crap. He didn't use the word crap, he used the other word, okay? And the other one told me, use it as a reason to stay sober. And that hit home with me. So I know death is a part of life now. You know, it's not, maybe, I don't know if I had a reservation, but it was just the pain that I was going through that I didn't know how to deal with. But they shook me, got me back on track. A couple months ago, I went back to Mississippi to bury my oldest sister, nephew, who was murdered. My oldest sister, son, basically, her oldest son, my nephew, who was murdered. And I went back there and I went through, and I ended up going to meetings. They have meetings in Mississippi too. Okay, they have meetings in Mississippi too. And while I was there, I seeked out the fellowship. And I went to meetings. And I had my contact group back here in Mississippi. Back here in California, I mean, Visalia. I had my sponsor that checked up on me, and I checked up on him. You know, that got me through those. So I know I don't have to drink over anything today. If James have a drink today, guess why? Because he wants you. Because he wants you. That's the only reason. No matter what's going on. But see, James don't want you today. You know, because I have a choice, you know. And I know what it was like. So I don't want you today. And what's keeping me from that? Not my free will. It's the fellowship. It's my higher power. It's my home group. It's working with others. It's being of service. It's having that compassionate heart. That was keeping me sober today. So, one day at a time, just for the day. You know, my life is pretty good, no matter what. You know, I was sharing about all the promises, you know, have a bank account. Some of the things, you know, I shared about the home, shared about the kids, my lovely family, shared about my friends in the fellowship, you know, because usually when I go into a room and greet people, one of my trademarks is howdy, friends and neighbors, you know, whether I know you or don't know you, you part of the fellowship. We're in this thing together. I can't do this by myself. I tried that. Didn't work. My best thinking got me in here. So I need you guys like we need each other. And it was talking about the life raft. You know, everybody pedaling together. And then once they get to shore, or the ship liner, you know, once they get there and they went through this peril together. And then they go on their separate ways, but they just remember how they pulled together to get through those moments. And that's what I need you guys for. No matter what we're going through in life, we can rely on one another to be there for each other to help us through. That's where it started. Bill and Bob, one alcoholic talking to another. And while they were talking, guess what? They realized, hell, I haven't had a drink. You know, this is I think it's a inspired program. I don't know how in the hell somebody came up with that analogy, is that they just get together and talk about their problem. They don't have to participate in that problem. Seem to work. Been working, what, how many years? 1934. Thank you. See? And that's something like that. When you don't know the big book, you got somebody here who will let you know the big book. You know, when you don't know, you got some old timers in here who will correct you. And they're not doing it to shame you, because we're here to share the message, facts. This is how it happened, not what we think it happened. It's a wonderful program. It's a wonderful program, you know. I'm going to use a message that I stole. I stole it because it's so true. Some of you guys might know where, I know one guy knows where it's coming from because he's here. It was this expression that, you know how you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink? But you sure can tell him how good that water is. So that's what I'm here for tonight, telling you the message that this program of Alcoholics Anonymous is real good. Here it is, guys. You better take a drink. It's real good. I'm not talking about alcohol. I'm talking about the message. Participating in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we can lead you here. We can't make you pick up the simple set of spiritual tools that laid at your feet. We can't make you pick them up, but we sure can mess up your drinking. We can mess up your drinking telling you how good it is. We can do that. We can mess up your drinking. You know, because next time you have a drink, you're going to start thinking, damn, that man shared that message. Now I don't even want to drink. You know? So that's what I'm here for tonight, guys, to share the message. What it was like, or how it was, what happened, and what it's like now. Thank you guys for listening.